Welcome to this episode of Coastal Catch-Ups. So this is a slightly different approach. Again, I am speaking to myself today, but the agenda of this podcast is questions from previous guests I've had on Coastal Catch-Ups. So basically, I've messaged people I've had a chat to about some things that are on their mind and some questions that they need answered. So they have been great in responding and sending a couple of messages through. And yeah, they're difficult questions, and I appreciate that I might not be an expert in the subject, but at the same time, it's allowed me to go away and learn a lot about the particular question and share some of the science behind the topic and some of my opinions on it. But nonetheless, I appreciate that I am probably covering it on a high level, and hopefully it's certainly enough for me to satisfy my curiosity. So hopefully it's enough for you as well. So without further ado, we will get into this episode.
About marine and the coastal sea, aquatic life and everything in between. So sit on them and take a seat. Coastal Catch-Ups with a stampede.
So this question comes from John Gilmore, who I chatted to in one of the first episodes of Coastal Catch-Ups. And John was wondering, are there any plans for tidal energy since the test turbine in the Narrows was dismantled? And what were the results of that test, good or bad? So there's a couple of parts to this question, and I have a responsibility to give you a bit of background to the question as well, if you're not familiar to this particular location we're talking about. So what is the background? The Narrows is a place in Strangford Loch on the east coast of Northern Ireland, and it's a sea inlet, and the channel entering into the loch is about 500 meters wide at its narrowest point. So the loch itself is about 150 kilometers squared in size. And just a bit about the background of Strangford. So it actually bears its name from the Vikings, and it means strong fjord. So that is a valley created from glacial activity. There's also an earlier Gaelic name, which is Loch Cuan. And it's that name you'd see quite often around the towns, particularly around the Narrows. And that means Loch of the Havens. So that's referring to the, actually once you get into the loch, I imagine it's coming from the importance of mariners seeking safety from the Irish Sea. So once you get in the loch, it's nice and peaceful. And funny enough, John actually mentioned that in his episode about the loch. So in terms of the Narrows Channel, you have Strangford on the west side, and then you have Portaferry on the east side, if you've been to those places before. And then in terms of the loch as well, before we get into the modern era of tidal energy, there's also evidence in the loch of settlements using the tides to create tidal mills for mechanical motion rather than generating electricity, obviously. So that was uncovered, and I think that dates back to around the 7th century. And that's around the monastery of Nendrum. So if you've ever been there, that's another wee fact for you. So humans have been at this for a long time. Obviously the technology's changed in that time. So how did the Narrows form? And this is the channel, the Narrow Channel in the Strangford Loch. So it is thought the channel was formed by melting ice sheets around 15,000 years ago. Large ice sheets covered the country and basically scraped their way across the landscape, and we can see marks of this left today, such as small bumps, and I suppose hills is a better term for it, but the actual term used to describe these hills are drumlins, and these form a lot of the islands in Strangford Loch, but you also have eroded drumlins, which are called platys. So they are covered by water. At high tide, they're mostly covered by water, and essentially submerged. That's one of the features. Another feature is glacial erratics, which are large boulders that have been picked up by the ice and transported as the ice sheet moves. So you get random boulders, and they're able to identify erratics by some smart geological dating. So they can tell that this boulder does not belong here and it's been transported here by the ice. And finally, there's old valleys formed by the meltwater, which ran under the ice sheets, and this caused erosion under the ice. At the current sea level, they are now channels in the loch. So there's, if you look at the map of the loch, you'll have the inlet at the narrows, and then you have a Y shape. So you have a deep channel running up the middle of the loch, and then also a part of the Y that goes off to the west, or east, and it's kind of, yeah, it makes that Y shape. So they're the deepest channels running down the middle of the loch. So we have a channel, but now we need to know why a channel creates strong tides. So just to give you a bit of background to tides, we get two high tides a day and two low tides per day. And this is known as a term, semi-diurnal tides. The incoming tide is called the flood tide, and the outgoing tide is known as the ebb tide. And it's controlled predominantly by the gravitational pull of the moon. So moon takes just under 1 month to rotate around the Earth. However, as the Earth spins on its axis, the water is always pulled towards the direction of the moon, and therefore the water is pulled in different directions around the Earth. Another force acting on the water is the sun, but as this is further away, the effect is not as large. Nonetheless, as the moon rotates around the Earth and is in line with the sun, we get a stronger tide known as spring tides. So, i.e. we have the force of the moon plus the sun at those stages. When the moon and the sun are not aligned, we have neap tides, which are slightly, so you get a lower high water and a higher, you get a lower high water and a higher low water. So the tidal range basically is not as high. I'll try and rephrase that probably. So your highs are not as high and your lows are not as low. That's the best way to explain it. So that's comparing your neaps and your springs. So the springs, you would get a higher tidal range, and your currents, therefore, your tidal currents are higher on your spring tides. So we get roughly about two phases of neap tides and two phases of spring tides per month. As I mentioned, the tidal range is higher in springs. We get a larger volume of water passing across the seabed. And then if we take this in the case of the narrows, we get all this water being forced through a narrow channel. And then this creates a very strong spring current, and it averages about 6.5 knots in the channel. That's according to the navigation charts, but as this is an average, it is known to get up to higher than this, over 7 knots. When I'm talking about knots, knots are nautical miles per hour, and this equates to roughly, it's about, I take it by meters per second, is half of the value of 1 knot. So if we're talking about 7 knots, we're talking about roughly about 3.5 meters a second, probably getting higher than this to 4 meters a second in the channel. So it's very, very quick. So naturally, this is an ideal place to investigate the potential for tidal energy. There was actually a study I read during my research for this. It has been estimated that there's around 350 million meters cubed of water enters and leaves the loch through the narrows on each tide. So that's an interesting fact, and it just shows you how much water is being forced through the channel. When you get this as well, I should mention, you get loads of features in the water column forming. You get tidal eddies, which are back currents, which appear. So the flow of the water in the eddies would be normally opposite to the direction of the main flow of water. You can get whirlpools forming and all this turbulence as well. So it's a really interesting place. The seabed really plays a part in all these features forming. If you have large boulders or outcrops of rock, you can notice that on the sea surface as well, the disturbance it's causing on the water. There's also, as the water's being forced through the channel, there's approximately a 2 hour offset in the times of high water and low water inside and outside the lock. So, i.e. if you're looking at somewhere, for example, Ardglass, high water could be at 2 o'clock, but high water inside the lock wouldn't be until about roughly 4 o'clock. So there's a delay because it's taking time for the water to enter the lock as well. So now we know a bit about tides and the rough geology of the Narrows, we need to know about how we can actually capture tidal energy. So according to the UK Marine Energy Council, there is potential for tidal energy to contribute to 11% of the UK's energy demand. One thing I'd like to point out that makes tidal energy different to other forms of renewable energy is that the moon and sun hopefully won't stop moving, or else we could have a disaster movie on our hands with like Bruce Willis or something. But all being well, they will continue, and they're reliable sources when you compare it to the likes of wind, sun and waves, which depend on the climate and the weather. You can also argue geothermal, but I don't know too much about that. I assume that's a more reliable. But anyway, we'll park that there. So apart from our variation in our neap and spring tides, they're pretty constant, the tides. One of the first methods of collecting tidal energy are tidal barrages, which are essentially dams which are placed in tidal streams, and they will most often span across a tidal estuary or a bay. And as you can imagine, this will completely change the tidal flow on the upper side of the structure. And in most cases, this will completely change the habitats in above the structure and destroy certain habitats as well, which rely on the rise and fall of tides. So it's a really hardcore way, and I know down in the south of France there's a tidal barrage currently working still, and there's none to my knowledge around the UK or Ireland. There are also tidal lagoons which don't span across an estuary or a bay, so their spatial requirement is far less, but it does require the construction of a breakwater to create a lagoon. A lagoon was nearly constructed in Swansea Bay, but was rejected by the government due to the cost benefit. And to my knowledge, support for another project in the area called Blue Eden is now being revived, and work is beginning again, led by private companies instead. The project, from a brief glance, looks exciting, with native oyster hatcheries in the lagoon, access to the lagoon breakwater for exercise and water sports within the lagoon, aquaculture and new habitats such as salt marshes. So the plan is, in this project in Swansea, that it'll create clean energy for around 155,000 homes and save over 230,000 tons of carbon emissions each year. So to me, this sounds like the future, and unless I'm missing a massive pitfall, I know there would be some constraints with construction and taking up an area of seabed, but I certainly at the minute support this type of innovation as a aiming for a sustainable future. So I've talked about tidal barrages and lagoons. There's also other methods being tested, some of which actually are being tested in the Narrows at the minute, and that includes underwater kites, which create a figure of eight motion. But to my knowledge, our development is in the early days, and it's in the research and development stage. And then lastly, we have harnessing tidal streams by placing underwater turbines in the water column, which brings us nicely onto the tide generation in the Narrows. So the turbines act as underwater windmills and require less energy compared to the wind farms, and that's due to the fact that water is denser and it requires less movement to power the blades. So in terms of the CGEN project, it was actually the world's first tidal turbine, which was commissioned in 2008. And I knew it was innovative, but I didn't actually realize it was the world's first. I was just starting secondary school at the time. Yeah, I suppose that's giving away my age. But yeah, it was decommissioned in 2019, and it was, I suppose, the first life cycle from a tidal turbine project from the cradle to the grave. So from the inception, the planning to decommissioning it and taking it off the seabed. So just to give you a flavour of the technology used on it, the turbine had two turbines on the structure. They turned it roughly about 14 revolutions per minute, and the tips of these blades turned at 12 meters a second. The turbine was piled into the seafloor with four pile structures, four legs, and the turbines themselves could be lifted in and out of the water for inspection by sliding up and down the structure. As it was a test, it was designed to be in the water for around 5 years after fulfilling all the, I'm sure the designers and maintenance folks had loads of technical questions that needed answered, and as this was the world's first, like, there's no standard guidance for this. This was proper research and development to see how a project like this would go ahead. And I suppose that goes for most cases in tidal energy, as it is still roughly in the research and development phase when you compare it to other renewable sources such as offshore wind. And yeah, like I said, there's no standardized practice and there's many uncertainties, and these uncertainties also probably hike the cost up as well. I suppose these uncertainties when it comes to getting investors interested as well, it's really important to reduce uncertainty when you're asking people to invest. So that's a bit of a background to the actual turbine. In terms of John's question then, was the project successful? I thought I'd answer this in two main themes, and the first one is the environmental side. So was it successful in terms of not having a significant impact on the environment in Strangford Lough? And then we'll look at the economic side, which the economic side is not really my forte, but I'll give it a good go and keep it simple, because I need to keep it simple for myself. In terms of Strangford Lough, it's heavily designated, and well, one of the designations is special area of conservation, and one of the priority species in that designation is the harbour seal, or also known as the common seal. And Strangford holds a significant population of breeding harbour seals, and it's been coined as the most important breeding site in Ireland. So you can imagine a fast spinning blade in a narrow channel, and you have seals bobbing about and swimming about. Like, there is potentially a significant risk there of collisions. So as this was a trial, there was a lot of stakeholders involved, between the environmental bodies and the government, and charities, environmental charities such as Ulster Wildlife, and as far as I'm aware, there was a lot of meetings to come up with a plan, and this led to extensive environmental monitoring being carried out, and it would ultimately provide valuable data for future projects down the line. But it was also, the data was collected prior to the installation. This is important. This is called defining your baseline. So you need to know what's happening at an area in terms of environmental receptors, such as, for example, in this case, seals. What's happening before, after you place a project, for example, a turbine, you can then really assess what the changes are in animal behavior or in terms of animal mortality. So that was the plan. So there was environmental monitoring before and during the project. I'm actually not sure, but I'm sure there's maybe monitoring after the project as well. I looked at the results of the environmental monitoring paper, or the report for you, and in particular I looked at the impacts on the seal species. So I mentioned about the common seal, you also have grey seals floating about there, and you also have harbour porpoises as well. You also have benthic communities on the seabed, which rely on the fast tidal flow bringing in nutrients that they can collect and eat. So all those communities on the seabed as well were assessed. So overall, for the marine mammals, there was it was concluded that there was no impact upon them during the 3 years of monitoring, as they were able to avoid the structure and therefore avoid collision. But it was noted that this required a local displacement of the population, so defined as around a few hundred meters, which I'm not sure what that means. Does it mean up to closer to a kilometer or 100 or 200? So I'm not sure, but because you need to remember that this is quite a narrow channel as well, so there's not really much room to play with. There was a decrease in porpoise activity during the installation, but sightings of porpoise remained stable over the longer term after installation. And they found that seals normally transited past the turbine at slack water, which actually coincided with the turbines not running until the current picked up to around 1 meter a second again. So there was downtime, and this was the time when seals seemed to transit around the narrows. So in terms of the benthic communities recorded, there was no impact, and it was suggested that these communities are used to turbulent tidal flows in the area, and therefore any additional turbulence created by the structure, it didn't impact these communities. They were used to it, and they were still able to do their thing by grabbing plankton and all the rest of it from the water column. It was noted that the monitoring was taken over a relatively short period of time, and therefore it is harder to find trends in species behavior or presence. So that, I suppose, that is one of the limitations of the monitoring. There was also searches for mortalities on nearby shorelines, and no mortalities were recovered in terms of marine mammals. So overall, it was pretty successful, and I think the stakeholders, there was an article I read, it got the green light. So I suppose the stakeholder meetings, they were happy enough with the results. So moving on from wildlife, the other environmental aspect I wanted to talk about was the climate aspect, and in particular carbon reduction. So the project saved around just over 2,000 tons of carbon per year, and its carbon payback time was around 8 months. This means this is the amount of time that the project needs to make up for all the carbon used in creating the machine, in terms of steel manufacturing, etc. If you think of all the embodied carbon in the structure itself. So it took 8 months for it to pay that back. I should mention, as this although is a great benefit, the aim of the project was to nail down the technology which can be used on a larger scale, and although therefore yes, it's obvious that this project would reduce carbon, the idea is getting the technology nailed down so it can do this on a larger scale. So that's our carbon reduction figures. Then I'm going to move on now to the economic results of the project. The project was able to export to the grid via a cable drilled beneath the seabed and connecting to the grid. And the energy capacity of the CGEN project was 1.2 megawatts. And I always struggle visualizing what this means. In work, sometimes I get told about offshore wind farms which do like 15 gigawatts, and I find it hard to visualize the concept of how much this is actually going to power, say, a town, for example. So to help, it was able to power around 1,500 homes each year. The turbines ran for about 20 hours a day, and then I imagine the other 4 hours, this was accounting for the periods of slack water, so the period in between the flood and ebb tide, where the current velocities were below 1 meters per second at the project site. So the like I mentioned about the seals, the turbines weren't running. So but it's good that, and it comes back to my other point as well about the consistency of tide. So although there is a bit of slack tide, the 20 hours a day will be 20 hours a day every day, rather than maybe 2 days, for example, in a wind farm, 2 days of good wind, and then you could have a high pressure system come in, and you could have a week without any wind. So this is consistent energy being generated. Just in terms of a case study by Jackson and Pearson's in 2012, they mentioned about the capital and operational maintenance costs, and they mentioned it about being reduced over the lifetime of a project. And they basically summarized by saying, assuming the current rate of development in the technology will remain, i.e. reducing costs and making efficiencies and standardizing processes, tidal energy will be feasible in the next 15 years and will continue to become more viable in the long run as new improved technologies are developed and appropriate incentives are given. So this case study is in 2012, but I also note that there are still articles being posted in this year actually, but still citing the need for innovation and reducing costs. So it's definitely a long game, the tidal renewable tidal energy industry, and there is support appearing from governments. For example, the UK government ring-fenced funding in their recent Contracts for Difference scheme, and this is a mechanism for supporting new low carbon infrastructure, and it basically guarantees a set price for electricity. So since it's stable, investors are more likely to want to basically guaranteed a certain amount of money from it. So I'm sure there's pros and cons to that system, but that's one of the ways that the government can support the industry. So after the success of the project, the company, but MCT, they plan to scale up the technology, like I said. Yes, that was for 10 megawatts, and that was a project called the Skerries Tidal Stream Array off the coast of Anglesey, North Wales. However, to my knowledge, this project did not go ahead after being granted planning permission. So I thought I'd come in here. I was reviewing this podcast and I thought I'd add this snippet in just to make it clear that the end of the MCT, so MCT were bought over by another company, and that project in Anglesey didn't go ahead, as I said, but that is in no means to say that there isn't other tidal projects ongoing in the UK, in particularly off the coast of Anglesey, and then up in Scotland there's some great examples of companies again trialing new technologies and new ways to do things, such as the Orbital project. So I just thought I'd pop that in there before I came to my conclusion. Cheers. So in conclusion, we've chatted about background to tidal energy, how the tides are formed, why the location of the tides in terms of the shape of the seabed is important in creating strong tidal streams. We talked about the technologies used to capture energy from tide. So we have the lagoons, which rely on the rise and fall of the tide. Then we also have the turbines, which can be placed in streams to turn blades. So back to the original question, as far as I know, there are no more plans for tidal energy in the Narrows, but the way the industry is moving, I would not be surprised if we see other devices. As I said about the tidal kites, it remains an important location for testing technology. In terms of the results of the project, from looking at the point of view that it was the first of its kind, it provided great data and lessons about the installation, maintenance and operation of the turbine, and then also the environmental data we talked about and how that can be informed decisions going forward. But this is the environmentalist coming out of me here, but every place is different, so the data can't be used to inform a decision, for example, off the coast of Wales, because you'd have a different location, different population sizes of marine mammals, for example. It every place is different, and hence why you have that planning process and the assessments and surveys need completed before any decisions are made. So it's a great case study for future projects. So all this can be taken forward to future projects and streamline the technology and planning process to make it more efficient. In terms of tidal energy, I think it'll be slow progress because there's a lot of articles about new technologies, so it's not like at the minute one way is the best way. There's definitely different things being tested, but I'm optimistic as long as the funding's there and the momentum and the motivation. I think we'll see more projects pop up around the UK. So I am optimistic. And if you're not familiar with tides and tidal energy in general, hopefully the background of the project in terms of the actual tidal processes and how it can be captured, I hope that was interesting as well for you. So that's the conclusion of this episode. Hope you found it interesting. If you have, make sure to give it a like or a review on whatever platform you're listening to it on. And yes, I will see you on the next episode. Thanks for listening.